My name's Phil Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. And probably the reason that they don't have a tape is because I don't have one. And this is a big deal for me. I've never spoken in front of a crowd this size. I come from grew up in a little town where, you know, the biggest thing we ever did was ride around, drank. Biggest places we used to go to party was out in the field at the Monstrosity or over at Rabbit Hill or somewhere like that and build a bonfire. And so, you know, that I didn't get around too much. And I've spoken at a few places, a few men's retreats and things like that. And when Brooke called the first time and asked, would I speak, I said, certainly, because I do what I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then hung up the phone, didn't think much about it. About 3 o'clock that morning, I woke my wife up, and I said, I can't go up to no Fort Wayne, Indiana, and speak at no convention. I don't know nothing about that, you know. But I am truly grateful to be here, and it's an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me my life, truly gave me my life. And if there's anything I can do in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'm asked, I do it. I don't want to be cocky or anything by saying this. I do this because I was asked to, because I'm only trying to ensure one person's sobriety today, and that's mine. Because as long as I've done what I've been asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous since February the 2nd of 1988, I hadn't found it necessary to take a drink or mind-altering drug or stick a needle in my arm or anything like that. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. And that is a big deal. You know, we say there ain't no big deals, but that's a big deal. That's a big deal to me. That's a big deal to my family. That's a big deal to my neighbor. One of my neighbors, one time I'd been sober, I guess, about 6-7 months, and he was out cutting grass, you know, and he was drinking a beer, offered me a beer over the fence, and he said, "You still going them classes?" I said, "Yeah, I'm still going them classes. You want a beer?" I said, "No, I don't think I do." He said, "Well, you know, ever since you've been going them classes, I ain't had to put my kids in my hallway in the middle of the night no more for gunfire going off over there." And he said, "You know, I'm really grateful about that. But, you know, at the same time, he was offering me a beer, you know, so they just don't understand, you know." And I didn't feel a need to explain to him. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 30 years old, a complete failure in every area of my life. I was unemployable. I was sick, physically sick, spiritually ill, and well, down at home we got a term, shot out. That's what I was. I was shot out. And you people took me in, and you loved me, and you didn't ask me where I'd been. You just said, "Come on in." And I have literally grown up in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I had never filed income tax or paid income tax. I'd filed once right out of high school because somebody told me I'd get some money back, and I let them fill out my taxes, and so they did, and I got some money back, and I never did it again until I was 3 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and cleaned up, started working, and the Internal Revenue got in touch with me. And it was a big deal for me, you know. I mean, I didn't know nothing about paying taxes. The only other time I'd had any confrontation with the Internal Revenue, they had sent an employer of mine a letter wanting to know how come I was working under two Social Security numbers and drawing unemployment that year. And he wrote them back and gave them my prison number and told them that I was incarcerated in one of their facilities and that they just need to go see me there. He didn't know. And that worked out fortunate for me because since they already had me, they didn't bother to do nothing. And then I got out and I didn't bother to pay, do nothing or get in touch with them. And I got sober and started working and cleaning up and trying to do the right thing. And it was on my fourth step about that. And I didn't know what to do. And thank God they got in touch with me. And thank God for sponsorship. He told me to get an attorney. Told me to turn my will and life over to the care of somebody that knew how to talk to them a lot better than I did. So I did. I signed over power of attorney, and I'm grateful to say today that I'm current with Internal Revenue. I pay taxes. I run a little business. I'm just old carpenter. I'm the chief executive, boss, labor, cleanup guy, bookkeeper, only employee, and make a good living at it. And I'm happy. Live in a little neighborhood with a one room, you know, all little houses look alike, and got a wife and two babies, and all the things that I thought I never wanted. When I started drinking, I grew up in a drinking home, and I grew up, my family's good people, and tried to teach me right from wrong. Did teach me right from wrong, but I was bullheaded. had something in me. I just rebelled from the get-go. I mean, if they said it was black, I said it was white. You know, it didn't matter. I just rebelled. And I had an uncle that I just adored. I mean, I thought he was the coolest thing in the world. He liked to ride motorcycles and drink all night and stay piled up in the bed to 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And he worked for his daddy, and my daddy owned a piano store. And he'd go try to start getting him out of bed at 9 and get him out back at work, you know, by 2 or 3. And then he'd quit by 6 and he'd go back to drinking. And I thought, man, he's got it made, you know. I want to be just like that. Well, I was. I'll never forget, I was about 10, 11 years old, something like that, and was over for my grandmother's birthday. And her birthday was on New Year's Eve, and so it's Christmas and her birthday, and we were down visiting, and he poured him a big tumbler of bourbon, Coke, and said, took a swallow and said, phew, that's strong, and handed it down there to me to give it a shot, and I knocked the top off of it, and it went down real good, and he did that a couple of times, and that's all I remember about that night. I remember crawling in that old Falcon he had and riding over to where my grandmother and them were, and the story is that she never drank. They had to spike her drink, try to get her tipsy so she wouldn't know how drunk I was. Run around, falling around, and all I remember is her getting me out of the front yard at his house, back at his house the next morning. And he said I threw up all over myself and wet my pants and passed out, and evidently I blacked out because I don't remember anything about it. And she woke me up in the front yard. Sun was shining, and I was cold, and I thought, Oh, I can't wait to do that again. You know, and I'm a real alcoholic, and what I say mean by that is I'm a person that could not drink no matter what I said, did, promised, swore, bet. It didn't make no difference. And my whole life, though, I thought I just changed my mind all the time. You know, I say, you know, you get in jail, you wake up in jail or something like that, you say, I ain't never drinking again. Soon as somebody makes bond and they come get you out, where do you stop? You stop at the liquor store. First thing, because, you know, you've been in jail. You're out. You got to celebrate. Got to have just one, you know. But you do that over and over and over again. When I was a little boy, coming up, we used to play Superman was big and all that, and we used to tie towels around our neck and fly around the yards, you know, with a towel. And I was about 5 years old, and I got a real Superman suit for Christmas with a big S, the cape, pants, the whole nine yards. And I put that thing on, and I got up on the porch, and I was fixing to fly around the neighborhood and show everybody how bulletproof I was. What a man of steel I was. I dove off that porch, and I hit the ground. I got up. Me and my daddy laugh about it today. They brushed me off, and I cried. I was humiliated. I felt terrible. I took that suit off. I never put it on again. Ever put it on again. Every time I took a drink, it was just like standing up on that porch rail, you know. And when I'd wake up in the morning, I felt sort of like I did laying on that ground. But I did it over and over and over again. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I was doomed to drink. I could not do it. Didn't know why. Don't know why. I have an allergy coupled with a compulsion that keeps me drinking once I take a drink. I could never, ever get enough. I did a lot of things. I stayed in trouble. I was in trouble from the time I was 14 years old to the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, either paying off for some wrecked car, paying a lawyer for some court deal. I was always in jails, you know, just in jails for everything, from DUI to public drunk to public indecency. Got locked up at the Waffle House, y'all, old Waffle House, for trolling. That's when you're walking in backwards, taking a leak with wind blowing behind you, so nobody won't know, you know. You know. And that, you know, everybody I run with was like that. You know, I mean, that, I didn't lose no wives, no good jobs, no big cars, no homes due to my alcoholism, because I didn't have nothing like that. If you drank like I did, you wouldn't have nothing like that either. I got started off real early and went real hard. I got one of my sponsors, Jack, we talk about, he's a high-bottom drunk, and he calls me a low-bottom drunk because he drank for 26 years. And I said, yeah, you didn't drink like I did. I didn't drink about 15 hard years, you know. And me and Jack, we're just real close and funny. His bottom was he throwed a flower pot through his wife's window, car window. And that's the worst thing he ever did. But his bottom and my bottom was the same. Something happened on the inside. I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't live like I was living anymore. I couldn't stand another day of me. I just couldn't take one more day of me. Something had to give. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to talk about coming in and getting sober, and I mean, you know, I did all the stuff. I'm a drunk. I mean, I drank till I just couldn't drink no more. I literally ended up drinking in the bed. My last 5 years of drinking, I stood up and threw up every day trying to get a drink down, praying to God I could get a drink down. With beads of sweat on top of your head, and just, God, can I get it down? I got to get it down. And not wanting to drink, and knowing I got to drink. Knowing I can't not drink. And God, that's a miserable place to live. Wishing I could die. Thinking, God, if they'd lock me up again, you know. You know, it's pretty sick when you think back about being incarcerated is the only time you had any consistency and stability in your life. You know, because I was scared to death of me out here. When I hit the streets, I didn't know what's going to happen. I didn't know what I was going to do, you know. I had no control over what I'd do. I'd do whatever came in the door, and we did. That's what I did, you know. I mean, if somebody said, let's go do it, I'd say, okay, let's go, you know. I just went with the flow. Tried to do a little bit of distribution. A little better living through chemistry. Stayed broke. You know, couldn't do it. I like to look good, you know what I mean? I like to look good. I like to show everybody how much money I got and what I got till it's all gone. And, you know, go to jail, get in trouble. That's what people used to say. That's all y'all do is ride around, drink, do dope, stay in trouble. You know, you ain't never going to be nothing. And I thought, you know, if a lot of you people could do like me and be sorry and get by and stay high all the time, y'all do it too. You know, you wouldn't, that's all you want to do because you're always over here getting high with me and then you go back and act like you ain't doing it. And I'm just a sick puppy. I come into AA, what happened to me is about 2.5 years before I got sober, my brother died of this illness. He drank himself to death at 30 years old. He blew a hole in his heart in withdrawals from alcohol. And it didn't affect me very much. I felt like I'd killed him. Because I had disowned him, and at the time I was on parole and I was trying to get straightened up enough to not go back to jail. And I was trying to mend up with him, so I got him out of jail. I went and spoke to the sheriff to let him come live with me. Now, you got to understand, it's a small area. He had been married to the sheriff's daughter twice. W.J. did not like Chris, my brother, in his jail. He did not like it because he caused a lot of trouble when he was in his jail. And so he went for it. He let him come out and move in with me, and I was trying to make amends. We got on a roll, and the way we drank, you know, we were on a big roll drinking, and the weekend before, and my brother, we were celebrating because my brother had paid off his car. You know, he'd never paid for anything his whole life. And This is first thing. Is you got one of them old cars, you buy here, pay here, and it's the first time he'd ever paid one off, that they didn't come pick it up or just leave it somewhere, you know, pay on it till you tear it up, and then, but he had paid it off. So we were up at the dam at Lake Lanier, and we were celebrating, so we burn it. Set it on fire and burn it and had a big party. And I left there, and me and this girl went to Tybee Island down at the beach for the weekend, and I got DUI. I don't know what DUI it was, but second or third on my last set of five. Coming back home, and I got caught by the state patrol. I was in a Mustang, and I was putting gas in the car when he finally caught me. And they locked me up. But she had to come back to Gwinnett County where I live to make bond, and my brother came back with her, and he was sick. And the first thing I did, got out of jail, stopped at the package store, and he didn't want to drink, and he kept saying he was feeling bad, and he didn't feel like drinking. And we'd been up for days. We'd been doing some of that, what Mick was talking about, that he called it crystal meth. We call it bathtub crank. We made it in a bathtub. Some of that's that kind of better living through chemistry. And been up for days, and he didn't take a drink. And I had been in court for DUI number two that afternoon. See, I used to get them so fast, sometime I could get out and go to court before they could count up how many it was. I went, got DUI number three, went to court on number two that afternoon. Got to work that stuff for it all to work out, you know. In Watkinsville. So I made it to court, drinking, and got through that deal and come back, and I never, the last words he ever said to me that night was, I feel like I'm going to die. And I told him I didn't think it'd be no great loss, and I walked out the door, and he died. He died from, they said alcohol poisoning, but he ain't had a drink all day. But he'd been drinking for quite a few weeks, hard and heavy. And I, through our self-pity and the way we feel, see, my brother always used to take up for me, all the time, take up for me, because I was always getting in trouble. And he was always having to come in and pull me out of some kind of mess, you know. And I'd always steal from him and take advantage of him and steal. You know how siblings are. But I felt like he'd ask for my help one more time and I'd turn my back on him. And for the next 2.5 years, I had a spiritual experience. When I walked out the door, I fell off the porch and shattered my ankle and ended up in hospital. And he died, and I must have felt like it was my fault, because the surgeon that did the surgery on my ankle, which was shattered, his only instructions was they kept pumping me full of Valium and morphine and not let me out till my brother was buried. And I talked to a nurse friend of mine later, and she said, he come out of there just scared to death. I don't know what you said under anesthesia, but you scared him to death. And you know, and looking back in hindsight, I feel like I felt responsible. And I got out, and I had a spiritual experience. Now, all this is going on, and you know how we are. I get out of the hospital. I don't go to my brother's funeral. I get some liquor. And I take all the pain pills that they give me from the hospital that day. Called them that evening wanting a refill on the script. and they told me I was crazy. And I had a friend of mine get me a bottle of Lord Calvert, and I was sitting there drinking, and the girl I was with at the time got all dressed up, Sunday best clothes, and said she was going to church. Well, I knew she wasn't going to church dressed like that. She said she couldn't take it anymore. I figured she was going out on the town. She's going to, you know, that's how where my head was. And so I called a friend of mine, come get me and take me home. That I wasn't going to sit around in that kind of mess. I need to go home. Well, that night I was drinking that liquor and sitting there in my bed. I couldn't walk. And I felt a presence, a spiritual experience, if you will. I felt the presence of my brother. And it was a message. And the message was, live as I live and you'll die as I died. And it's all for nothing. And I'll never forget it. My daddy called me at 6 o'clock that morning crying, saying, do something. I don't want to go to no more funerals. I got on the phone, called all my buddies, told them the Holy Ghost had been over here last night. And I had witnessed the Holy Ghost. And didn't do a thing. Didn't make any changes. Kept doing the same thing. And it got worse. And I got sicker. And I ended up nothing, you know, our bottoms. I mean, nothing different. Same thing. Ended up in the hospital. Withdrawal from alcohol. 2.5 years later. Sick. My liver was swollen up. I didn't know it at the time. I had a liver disease. Didn't know it until I was 4 or 5 years sober. But that and a combination of things I had done had made me real, real sick, physically real, real sick, and ended up in a trauma ward. And doctors was telling me I need help and that thing and another. And I was like, you know, like we are, get out of my face. I got some place to go. As soon as I can get well, I'm getting out of here. And my higher power sent a little old lady named Angela Hagedon, who was a social worker. And all she said to me was, I think I know a place that can help you. If I can get you in, will you go? And I just felt tired. And I didn't want to hurt her feelings. And I had already made arrangements to leave, and I said yes. And I had planned on going. I was lying to her. And next thing I know, here come paramedics carrying me to this little Buford Treatment Center where I got sober. And I went through detox there, and as I got detoxed, and I just couldn't buy it. I just couldn't buy what them people were talking about. They were talking about a higher power, and you need to find a higher power. And they were big book thumpers. And I just couldn't buy it, you know. And I guess I thought I wasn't. I don't know what I thought. I just thought it wasn't for me. And I went to a meeting, and I don't know if this is what triggered it or not, but I heard a guy say in a meeting that his mind was out to get his you know what, and a light came on, and I started having moments of clarity. I started thinking about the things that I had done in my life when my gut had been saying don't do it, you don't do it, and my head had said you gotta go. You got to do it, and where not I end up in jail or in trouble, you know, of some kind, and I started thinking about that, and I thought about I got out of a federal institution and I was heading home and went through Knoxville, Tennessee, and the bus. I had all these good intentions. People had been in the parole board. I had lost my parole date due to buck and some paraphernalia and stuff like that. Nothing bad, big. And people had been in the parole board trying to get me out, got you a job, really pulling for me, helping me. I was going to straighten out my life at that time and get married do better. And the bus stopped for a 15-minute layover in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I saw a neon sign. And I said, well, it won't hurt to get a couple of beers. And so, I hadn't planned on drinking. I was not going to drink. I wasn't going to get in no trouble. Wasn't going to mess up again. I ran up beers, killed two of them at the bar, put four in my pockets, and got back on the bus. Needless to say, I didn't show up for the parole office the next day. I was able to skate through it and show up the next day, come up with those excuses and get through it. But I was, all those good intentions went right out the window. And within 6 months, I was like, not only had I not been locked up for the last 2 years, I was worse off than I was when I went to jail, physically, mentally. And then in a couple more weeks, everybody at the around the bars and stuff was telling stories like I'd never even been gone, and I was believing them. But I thought about that instance, sitting there, and I thought, that's what it is. My mind is out to get me. And I've been listening to it all my life, and it's been getting me in trouble. And I fell to my knees. I didn't get on my knees. I fell to my knees, and I said, God, I don't know who you are or what you are, but I need your help, and I'm willing to do whatever it'll take. And I hadn't had a drink since. Now, I didn't have a spiritual light come on, and the recovery process has been real slow for me. I had a change. Something changed in me. I got involved in AA. I started going to meetings. They said you need to start working with alcoholics. Well, my group at that time met in the basement of a treatment center. So we had plenty of alcoholics to work with. So I start working with alcoholics. I start picking them up, taking them to functions and dances and things in the AA and all that kind of stuff. Started doing that. Did that for about 6 months. They figured out I didn't have no driver's license or no car. I was borrowing a car and driving it and going and picking them up. They thought that the insurance wouldn't work on that. I hadn't driven a car in 3 years. Because I was a double habitual violator, whatever that is, and hadn't had no license in a long time. But you know how we are. I got sober. I've asked this power to help me, so I go out in the backyard and I get that old Volkswagen. Ain't got a place that ain't dented on it nowhere. And I get the dirt dauber's nest out of the carburetor, and I start driving to meetings. I'm driving to meetings, because I'm going to be sober. I'm going to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Can't ask nobody for help, see. I can't ask nobody for help, but I'm going to them meetings. I'm going to meetings all the time. I'm going two or three times a day. I ain't working. So I'm going to meetings. I I was up at a friend's house and there was a license check. So I turn around and go back. I was telling somebody the next day, God's working my program. I didn't get locked up. But 2 or 3 weeks later, I was going to my home group to the meeting, and sure enough, there's a license check. And I go in line, and I pull right up through there and whoop out my ID, hand it to him. He hands it back and says, thank you, Mr. Moore. And I drove on to the meeting and I got out and I said, God's working my program. Blinded him. He looked at that ID and just said, go on. And Denny P. pulled me to the side in a nice way after the meeting and said, you little so-and-so and so-and-so, who says you ever think God might be trying to tell you quit driving that car? I said, no. I said, you ought to think about that. Sure enough, he laid a curse on me. I was going home that night. I got stopped with a taillight out. And I got locked up for being a habitual violator, stolen tag, no insurance. And I went to jail, sober, you know. And because I wouldn't, you know. But at that time, I said, you know, I know why I'm in jail. It was the first time I ever knew why I was in jail. You know, I knew I was in jail for driving on a revoked license, no insurance, and stealing somebody's tag and putting it on the car. And I knew that, and I accepted that for the first time. And I said, I ain't going to drink no matter what. I said, if you'll get me through it, if it's your will for me to go back, then I will. And I ain't going to drink, because I didn't want to go back living like I was living anymore. Things were happening to me. Even though my actions, I wasn't doing right, things were happening to me. There was something going on inside, and I wanted it. I could see it in other people, and I wanted it. I didn't know how to get there. See, I didn't know how to live. All the stuff, I didn't think it was wrong to steal a tag and drive a car when you needed to go somewhere, you know. I mean, I always thought it's okay to steal if you need it. You just don't steal if you don't need it, you know. But if you need something, it's all right. And but that was the way I thought. I mean, and I, you know, people laughed at me because when I went into treatment, this girl that I was hanging with stole everything I had. My complete life's savings, retirement, everything. $400. Everything I owned. I had had a little bit of reefer, and I peddled it out for my first 90 days sober to live on. I'm not proud of that fact, and I don't think that's, you know, nothing honorable about it, but I did to live. And when that run out, me and God and the big book and a baseball bat went over and kicked her door down and told her she better pay me my money because I'm sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if she didn't, her husband, who was getting out the next weekend for his last 2-year stench in the Georgia system, I was going to tell him who she'd been sleeping with for the last 2 years when she went up there to visit him on Sunday. And she paid me. So, I mean, I didn't do things right. I didn't come in here and get all spiritual. But something had changed in me. I was about 11 months sober, and I was going to meetings and going to meetings all the time, doing all these things and reading that book, Me and God in the Big Book, because I had this power I didn't know nothing about. I'd pray to him. I'd be brushing my teeth, say, God, keep me sober today. You know, my own conception of God. And I learned how to pray. I learned how to pray. I'd be on my knees saying, God, and I was telling him all about stuff, and I'd say, I'm lying. Shh, lying. And that's how I learned. I learned by just trying to talk to that power. And I was about 11 months sober, and I was stark raving sober. And I was coming up on my birthday, getting close to my birthday, and my group wanted me to speak. Not at my birthday, but trying to get me to speak, and I said no. And so they asked me again, and I said no. And then they asked me to be a backup speaker for a speaker that was coming, and I said I would. And so I told my story at 11 months first time, And I believe that if I hadn't, they knew what I did, and if I hadn't told, I don't believe I'd have ever stayed. I needed to hear it. And I was thinking that if this is all there is, I don't want it, you know. I'm riding around, my insides are just dying. I'm dying on the inside. I'm so uncomfortable in my own skin. And I don't know what to do, you know. And somebody, thank God, somebody pulled me to the side and said, "This ain't all there is. It's all you're willing to do. And you need to get in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to get in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he took me to a men's retreat, Atlanta Men's Workshop. And I've been watching this guy around, and I didn't want to go down there. I mean, I'm 11 months sober. I don't want to go nowhere, no 300 men. I didn't care nothing about that. But I did it because I was hurting inside, and I didn't know what to do. And I knew I was probably going to drink again. And I knew that if something didn't change in me, I was going to have to drink again. And my mind was telling me, "You got almost a year. Who you think you fooling? You gonna do what you always did. You can't not do it. You know, you ain't no good. That's all you gonna do. You gonna drink till you die. That's all you gonna do." And I went down there, and there's these 300 guys, and I felt uncomfortable. I was scared to death. And that Sunday morning, I'd been praying for God. You know, me and God in the big book, working in big book. And I was asking God for help. And at Sunday morning, I said, "I felt it." And I said, "I hear you. What's missing? People. I hadn't let nobody in. I ain't let nobody know who I am." And I said, "I heard you." And this guy I'd been seeing ever since I'd been sober, taking people around to meetings, picking up newcomers. He was speaking all over and doing all these things, active in the program. And a friend of mine said, "You need to ask Cliff to be your sponsor." And I said, "I don't know." And so he's the one that got me to go down to that retreat. And first thing he said, I didn't know him that well, was how he hated red-headed people. And he never had light red-headed people. Just something about them made me mad first time, you know. But at the end of that weekend, I'd watched him. I watched him down there, and I watched him. People would call and say, "Hey, Cliff, come here. I need to talk to you. I want to share with this man." They wanted to talk to him. Hadn't seen him in a while. Wanted to share with him. He was doing that all the time. People were pulling him aside because, like, he had something. And I wanted it. What I saw was, and I told him, I asked him to be my sponsor that Sunday on the way home. And I said, "Because I see that you're okay with who you are." And I said, "And because you're okay with who you are, other people accept you for who you are." And I said, "I am not okay with who I am. I said, I'm dying on the inside. I said, I am so uncomfortable in my own skin, I can't stand it. And that's what I want." And we started working together. I did an inventory, and I did a fifth step with him. And for the first time in my sobriety, after that fifth step, I truly felt like, see, up until that point, there was this thing in me is like, I thought I might have to drink, that I may have to go back. And that was the first glimpse that I felt like if I did this thing, I may never have to drink again. May never have to. I got a glimpse of that I may never have to drink again. And we started working the steps, and I started looking at my defects. And I always say, I got all my defects, got them all down, took an honest look out of my inventory, And what'd God do? Showed them all to me in sobriety. And I make a choice whether I want to practice them or I want to ask for help and do something different. And I started to get into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and started to make amends and try to clean up my act and started making restitution and doing some things that I didn't want to do. And it's amazing, you know. Here I am, 12 years later, I'm current with Internal Revenue. I met my wife in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God that I always say, see, I had to get 8 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when she is just getting sober. Because I was that much sicker than her. By the time I saw her, and she typically was, she's not somebody I would have been attracted to. I had been through the ropes in AA of sporting around till I was just sick of sporting around. And I was okay with me and didn't care if I ever found anybody again. And it was all right. Things were good in my life. And what happened was my sponsor made me move in this little bitty 600 square foot house so that I wouldn't take no more strays in. When I first got sober, I started a halfway house so that I'd have a place to live. Didn't do a lot of things right, but... And I moved in that little place, and after a little while, and I got to working for myself and doing some things, and I wanted something more. And I went to a mortgager and said, I want a house. I want to buy a house. He said I didn't qualify for a doghouse. And he did my financial statement. He said I didn't qualify for a doghouse. So I got to calling some people I knew, and one of the builders that I worked for said they would sell me a lot if I could get financing. Well, happened the bank they were using, the guy I had drank with at the bank, and I'd been sober 7 years, and he knew it, and I got to talking with him, and he gave me a loan to buy a lot and build a house on my name, you know, with no financial statement. And, I mean, when I walked out of that bank, I said, you know, all I could think about, Dances with Wolves is one of my favorite old movies, and all I could think about is at the end of the movie when the Indian's standing up on the mountain and he's telling Kevin Costner that, don't you know that I'm your friend and I'll always be your friend? That's all I could think about. That's my God. That's my God. I mean, there's absolutely no way that I could get a loan to do the things that I was doing there. I was doing it, you know. And it's just awesome. My sponsor used to rag me when I was building that house, just a little house. It's just enough for me. He said, build it and she'll come. I finished the house and moved in January 96. Met my wife February 96. We're celebrating 3 years of marriage this month. Have two children. We both worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was thinking about, we went through some things when we got married, and do we want to have kids or not? We were starting pretty late. I was 40 years old. And we talked about it, and see, I didn't know. I mean, I taught my wife wanted kids, and I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I got what it takes. You know, I really don't know. I mean, I look at my history, where I come from and the way I live, I don't know. About 3 months after we was married, she got pregnant. We decided we'd try, and she got pregnant. My little girl was born. And I was there. And I want to tell you something. When that nurse put that baby girl in my hands, I instantly knew that I could not love her, that I would love her for the rest of my life. Now, I know there's children born every day, and I know there's parents that go through that, but that ain't the deal. The deal is that I went through it. I experienced it. I felt it, and I know it. And I was talking to my wife afterwards, and I said, you know, that must be how God feels about us. That's the only conception. That's the only way I can understand it, because I can't understand it. And I knew right then, I knew she's going to do a lot of things I ain't going to like. But I knew I could not love her. And that's my God. That's how He talks to me. My little boy is the same way. Last year, we've been doing good. Things have been doing well. We was thinking about moving. And told my wife that morning I was going to work, and we were going to meet for dinner, and going to a meeting after work. And I did what I always do. I got up that morning and asked for God's will in my life, for His direction and guidance. And I went to work, and I was up on a scaffold, and I fell. Board broke, and I fell. Messed me up bad. Broke me up. See, I didn't have any insurance. This little liver disease that I got while I was out there has kept me from getting any kind of medical coverage or anything like that. And I thought, I ended up in the hospital, out of work for 8 months. Hospital I was in, had to start telling people, please don't come down here. With hundreds of AA people in halls lining up. People can't get to see the people they come to see, because they were all there to support us. I mean, you know what that feels like? You come from where I come from, and you're standing there and in your worst time, and I mean, they're just everywhere. There were people set with me around the clock. My wife was 8 months pregnant at the time. And somebody from AA with us around the clock for months. Our bills got paid. People from AA all over the country, from Virginia, Florida, helped us, took care of us. My wife, I mean, she had her hands full. I was all broke up, couldn't. She had 3 babies to change diapers on. But y'all were there, you know. God, that's awesome. That's how my God works. Carried us right through. My life is just, I mean, man. And I think about this. I think about it all the time. I almost missed it. God, I almost missed it. I see that little girl and that little boy every morning and every night. And I'm there and I'm a part of their lives. And God, I almost missed it. I almost missed it. This is the greatest deal going. I mean, if you're sitting there and, like people have said before, you don't understand, you don't see, you just got to hang in there. You just got to keep coming back. You got to want to. That's the way I was. I just started to want to. God, I wanted to do what y'all was doing, you know? And little by little, I kept plugging at it, trying, suiting up and showing up. That's one of the greatest tools that I have today. Greatest tools that I have today. I wake up in the morning and my head says, glad you're up. Been meaning to talk to you.
Bad. Bad.
And my sponsor said, you suit up and you show up. Show up in the bathroom and brush your teeth. Get on your knees and ask for guidance. I can't go to work today. You just suit up and you show up. And that's what I started doing here. I just started suiting up and showing up. And that's what I did when I was asked to come down here. I scared to death to come down here. I won't stand up here. I suit up and show up. I do what I have to do. Because I do not want to go back to where I came from. I think about Denny P. that helped me so much and pulled me aside in the early days and helped me to work the steps. Got a call the other day. One of his sayings he always used to say, I gain my sobriety one day at a time, and I can lose it one day at a time if I don't do the things that I'm supposed to do. Then he'd been drinking about a year. He quit doing what we were doing. He quit going to meetings. He got everything he ever wanted in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got his family back. He got a business. He got money. He got prosperity. I think Jack said, two worst enemies of alcoholics, health and prosperity. He got everything, all of his dreams. They never could have children. He got children. He got everything they ever wanted. But he's okay, see. He ain't messed up yet. And I think about that. Those are lessons for me to learn. I can't do that. If this disease is progressive, if I go back to drinking, I don't get to go back where I came from. I get to go back like I've been drinking for the last 12 years in just a short time, and I ain't going to make it. I don't want to go back to that. I don't want to go back. My life is in somewhat order today. It's very small, but it's very good. We got love in our home. Out of everything in Alcoholics Anonymous, the two things that mean so much is love and caring. You can't have one without the other. And I just thank God that I care today. Thank you.